Our brother Roger's first session this evening is entitled How to Appreciate the Purpose and Practice of Bible Study. Without further ado, call upon our brother Roger Lewis.
Thanks, Brother David, and good evening to you all. So our title then for our opening study tonight, bearing in mind that some of you have travelled, and so we're not going to actually try and drown you with ideas tonight, but we want to use tonight as a basis for introducing what we hope to cover, God willing, in the course of our main day tomorrow. Actually, this is what in New Zealand we would call a School of the Prophets number one. And School of the Prophets number one is the one that you've got to go through in order to go to a number two. So there's a certain amount of logic to that, as you can appreciate. But the reason why we do that is because in what we would cover in our number one School of the Prophets, we believe that unless young men have been through some of the basics of Bible study process, and more importantly, the discipline of Bible study, is that they won't have a good and positive experience at some of the later schools of the prophets that they might attend, where we really do engage with some of the more difficult aspects of Bible study and Bible thinking and Bible discussion. So we want to know that we've started with every young man that comes to our School of the Prophets, that they began with the foundation building blocks and have practiced those with enough commitment to be able to really value and appreciate the subsequent schools that they might attend. So this is our number one. In fact, hopefully tomorrow I'll try and put on a screen for you what we do in number two, just so you can see how we would naturally progress from what we'll cover, God willing, in the course of this weekend to our second round, as it were. And I wanted to start by just making this observation, which you know to be true and I know to be true, but really this is, to my mind, what the School of the Prophets are all about in terms of reminding ourselves, and that's this, that the theme of Scripture is fundamentally about the fact that there are two different seeds and two different modes of thinking associated with those seeds. And one of the things that we've got to remember, particularly living in the world of humanism as we do, is that the thinking of the seed of the serpent is so utterly different to the thinking of the seed of the woman that we need to be absolutely clear and then absolutely committed to spiritual thinking and spiritual behaviour. And there's no shortcuts to that process. So John 6:63 says, "It is the spirit that quickeneth, the flesh profiteth nothing. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life." And clearly these two words are being used deliberately in contrast to each other, aren't they? Spirit versus flesh. Now, it's the same in Romans 8, where it says in verses 6 and 7 that the minding of the flesh is death, but the minding of the spirit is life and peace, because the minding of the flesh is enmity against God. And we need to somehow realise that those phrases really mean an entire mode of thinking, which we will, whether we do it consciously or unconsciously, we will tend to adopt one of those two modes of thinking. We will either think according to the thinking of the flesh, or we will think according to the thinking of the spirit. Now here's the challenge. We're hardwired to think according to the flesh. The thinking of the spirit is alien to our nature. We are never going to think according to the spirit unless we have a disciplined process of absorbing the mind of the spirit. It won't happen otherwise. We will default always to the thinking of the flesh. And given the age of humanism and rampant humanistic thinking that we live in and live among day by day, this is a challenge as every generation arises. It was a challenge in our day. I think it's an even greater challenge in your day, because you're bombarded with the thinking of the flesh. if I can use these two colours, not that they're as quite as dramatic as I would have liked, they look brilliant on my Apple computer, but not so great on the screen. But if you just imagine a vivid blue and a vivid red, it's the red line versus the blue line. And the reality is that we are supposed to be the men of the blue line. Blue line in our thinking, the thinking of the spirit. But we've got to make a conscious commitment to get to that process. Galatians chapter 5 says, walk in the spirit, and ye shall not fulfil the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary the one to the other. And so not only is there a difference between flesh and spirit, but Galatians says they're actually at war. They're contrary to one another. There is a conflict going on between these two modes of thinking. Now, we know all of this at an intellectual level, but of course, this is the reality that we face every day of our lives. And it's also a reality that comes into our ecclesias and a reality that comes into our families. And by virtue of the structure that God has appointed for ecclesial life and family life, if we, as brothers in the truth, and as young men growing up to be strong in the word, if we don't give the lead as to the thinking of the Spirit, then neither will our families or our ecclesias reflect that thinking. So this is our primary responsibility. And of course, I think one of the big lessons that we hope to take out of our whole weekend is we're not just doing this for the purpose of speaking according to the Spirit. We're learning these principles so that we can think according to the Spirit. It's about the mode of thinking that lies at the foundation of everything related to our spiritual life in the truth. So Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 14 changes the word spirit and flesh and says, God will bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. But it's the same two colours really, isn't it? That which is good is the thinking of the spirit. That which is evil is the thinking of the flesh. Romans chapter 12 and verses 9 and 21 says, abhor that which is evil and cleave to that which is good. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. And lastly, in 3 John verse 11, beloved, follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. He that doeth good is of God, but he that doeth evil hath not seen God. And we suddenly realise that actually, from a Bible point of view, you can take this same language and simply put several different words in. Not only could we have flesh versus spirit, but we could have good versus evil. What else could we have? Any thoughts? Give me another two words that describe the red line versus the blue line.
Light and darkness.
Light and darkness. Any others? Yes.
Carnal, spiritual.
Carnal versus spiritual. Any others?
God and man.
God and man. Any others?
Heavenly and terrestrial.
Heavenly and terrestrial, that which is above, that which is beneath. When you start thinking about it, you'll suddenly see red line versus blue line in a number of different ways of putting the same idea, but it's the same controversy. And that's why we suggest that controversy is the conflict of the ages and the conflict of the Bible. The controversy between those two modes of thinking is absolutely fundamental to the divine purpose. Now, here's the interesting thing. How did life begin in the book of Genesis? It began with the blue line. And in Genesis, man first introduced a rival, alternative mode of thinking in the Garden of Eden. And from that time forth, the story of the Bible and the story of the purpose of God is the controversy, the enmity, the battle between the red line and the blue line. Until what? Until what happens? Until the blue line triumphs, as triumph it will, because it is God's line. So there's already no doubt about the outcome of the battle. The blue line will win. But the question is, will we be part of the blue line? That's the challenge for every generation in the truth. And at the heart and soul of it lies our fundamental mode of thinking. Do you remember in Genesis chapter 3, it says this, I'll put enmity between thee, the serpent, the red line, and the woman, the blue line, between thy seed, the serpent's seed, the red line, and her seed, the woman's seed, the blue line. He shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. So there's the controversy at the start of the Bible, Genesis chapter 3. And we come to the book of Revelation, chapter 12 and verses 15 to 17. It says, the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, and was wroth the woman, and went to make war, enmity, with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God. And we suddenly realise that the language of Revelation chapter 12, serpent, woman, enmity, seed, is all taken out of the language of Genesis chapter 3. But now we're in the last chapter, the last book of the Bible. So from the start of the Bible to the end of the Bible, there's only ever been one controversy. There's only ever been one rivalry. There's only ever been one enmity. There's only ever been one battle between these two fundamental modes of thinking. Now, you might say, by the way, oh, that's all very dramatic as a beginning. Believe me, we're at war. And if you don't think that you're at war, I can tell you that the seed of the serpent is. So some of you will have seen this passage, but I don't think it's lost any power in the retelling of it. So this is a quotation from the Humanist magazine in 1983. And what it said was, Dunphy said, I'm convinced that the battle, seen at that term, controversy or enmity, the battle for mankind's future must be waged and won by teachers who correctly perceive their role as the proselytizers of a new faith. A religion of humanity that recognizes and respects the spark of divinity in every human being. These teachers must embody the same dedication as the most rabid, fundamentalist preachers, alias Christadelphians. For they will be ministers of another sort, utilizing the classroom instead of the pulpit to convey humanist values. The classroom must and will become an arena of conflict between the old and the new, the rotting corpse of Christianity and the new faith of humanism. And I think that what that quotation tells us is that the seed of the serpent's at war. The question is, are the seed of the woman at war? Well, we better be. And by the way, what would your estimate be, since that was written in 1983, 1993, 2003, 2013? What do you think's happened in the classroom in the last 30 years? Do you think the seed of the serpent's won? Absolutely and totally. In fact, the seed of the serpent would have won in many Christian schools. Let alone the public system. So I don't think we're over-dramatising the situation when we say that we're in the midst of a battle. And what is it a battle for? It's a battle for the mind. We're engaged in a battle for the mind. And isn't that really what the truth's all about? It's about developing the mind of the Father. And that's the whole challenge of our spiritual life and the truth. So here's the reality. The doctrine of the seed of the serpent is a mode of thinking known as the thinking of the flesh, which is utterly focused on self. And we are hardwired to do that every day of our lives. The funny thing is, it's much truer than we realise. Who here wouldn't have heard of God manifestation? Who here wouldn't believe in God manifestation? Who here wouldn't say that the truth is all about us learning to manifest the Father? And yet, every day of our lives, aren't we incredibly focused on ourselves? What we're going to do today, the problems we're going to face today, what we're going to try and achieve today, what we're going to do with our family today, what the problem will be with regard to this or that or any one of a thousand other things, all focused on self, all day. And these are from people who do believe in God manifestation. We're still focused on self. We're not focused on God. Are we? Not really. I don't think so. So we espouse intellectually the doctrine of God manifestation, but at a practical level, in our lives every day, we show every minute that in fact we're subject to the thinking of the serpent dominating our minds. You know, this is a slight digression, but it's an interesting one. You know, that grandma used to have a rule for dealing with problems of stress, and grandma's rule was, before you say or do anything, count to 10. Grandma didn't know why that worked. She just knew that it did. Do you know why it does work? You don't know why counting to 10 works? Before you say something? Anything? Any thoughts on that?
It's what you say at one is the thinking of the flesh. And by the time you get to 10, there's an opportunity for the spiritual mind to take over.
Exactly right. Anyone know how that happens?
The brain.
Yeah, what happens is that if you respond, actually I'll use a different word because I prefer it, if you react instantly, what happens is the amygdala is triggered, and the amygdala is our fight-flight syndrome or response, but it's essentially the reptilian part of the brain. And our immediate reaction to any circumstance or any event is a triggering of the amygdala. And that response is the thinking of the flesh. It's immediate, it's instinctive, it's hardwired, it's reptilian. Isn't it interesting how even the world will call it the reptilian brain? It's so utterly appropriate, isn't it? But if you count to 10, what happens is the whole bodily psyche, the system, the physiology of the body, calms enough for the neocortex part of the brain to take over and postulate a rational response based on higher principles. Enter the spirit's mode of thinking. So the difference between 1 and 10, as David says, is literally the difference between the thinking of the flesh and the thinking of the spirit, because the thinking of the flesh is triggered at the primitive brain level, but the thinking of the spirit is triggered at what's called neocortex level. And you know what Brother Thomas said? Count one, and what you get is propensities. Count to 10, and what will be triggered is moral sentiment. Brother Thomas had all this right a long, long time ago. It's exactly right. In fact, the latest neurological research says that there are three layers of our brain development, and they answer to the three exact categories that Brother Thomas talked about a long time ago in terms of propensities, intellect, and moral sentiment. And counting from 1 to 10 is actually a bit of a key to making sure that the thinking of the spirit can prevail, that it can actually conquer our initial primitive response, which is always going to be the thinking of the flesh. So we've got to find the mechanism that will allow us to move beyond that, because we're hardwired to do that. Now, I'm just going to run through two or three of these slides quickly, because some of you will have seen these before, but I think, nevertheless, that they are, again, a good introduction to our topic tonight, which is really about appreciating the purpose of Bible study. Many of you will know that in the pre-modern era, the characteristic response of life was to believe what had been already promulgated as the doctrine of the day. And so the watchword of the pre-modernist society was that you were asked to believe because you'd been told what you needed to know or what you needed to learn. But when modernism became established, it was based now on what they at least thought was the powers of objective thought and rational order and the logic of reason. And so now, instead of man saying that it's all about that you must believe, now it's all about you must know, because it was considered that everything can be proved and be provable. The funny thing was that modernism in the end left people cold, because it was so scientifically and academically based that all of the emotional psyche of people were not fulfilled by the doctrine of modernism. And so postmodernism entered the world, and truth now, as far as how postmodernism would define it, is the subjective opinion and personal experience of each individual. And so the watchword of postmodernism is I feel. And so notice that we've gone from I believe, which is an article of faith, to I know, which is an article of logic, to I feel, which is an article of emotion. And that now becomes the trump card for every problem to be reasoned in life. Ah, but I feel this. I feel that. Actually, to be really honest, I don't care what you feel. And by the way, just so that you know, I'm completely impartial. I don't care what I feel either. But I very much care for what God says, because that's the only basis for spiritual thinking. What you feel and what I feel is gloriously irrelevant to the Father's purpose. And so that's the age in which we live. We've got to at least see that challenge and learn how to respond to it. So mad has postmodernism become that religion is now not about conformity to doctrines, it's about your personal mystical experience. It's a framework for personal discovery. So really, religion's all about you. It's all about getting in touch with your inner self. You can see which way religion's going to go once it's run by postmodern thinking. History is not about what actually happened. It's about the cultural bias of the historian. So the only thing a historian can tell us is what he thought happened, not what actually happened at all. So there's no history books that we can rely on anymore. Educators are purely biased facilitators of knowledge, and efforts to teach children to conform to established rules is actually domination. You can't do that. Rules? There's no room for rules in a postmodern world. And if the Bible has rules or God has rules, well, then they must be wrong, because we don't do rules in a postmodern world in terms of the thinking of the flesh. I really love this one. Literature under postmodern thinking says that the author is irrelevant to meaning, that the reader, therefore, becomes the centre of learning. And therefore, we now have the opportunity to deconstruct the text to give the meaning that the reader would like to give to it. So if I read a book, it's completely irrelevant what the writer actually wanted to say, or what the writer intended, or what even the writer meant. After all, what would the writer know about the book? He only wrote it. I am the reader. And as the reader of the book, the all-important thing is for me to decide what I believe the text might teach or not teach, based on what value it will bring to me. Now, can you imagine that mindset applied to Bible study? See, what distinguishes us as Christadelphians from church ministers doing sermons is a church minister says, what do I want to talk on today? Can I find a couple of Bible passages that I can use as the basis for the sermon that I want to give on the topic that I'm interested in? That's not how we study, is it? We study on the basis of saying, what is the Father trying to tell us in this passage? What is the Father's objective? What is the Father's purpose? What is the divine principle encapsulated here? And we seek the Father's blessing upon that, what we do with his word, because we want to be guided by the Father's intentions with regard to the text. For us, the writer is supreme. And the reader's job is to humbly seek to understand what the writer intended. We live in a post-modern world of such madness that if you start that in terms of your mode of Bible study, well, you will be successful in fashioning a religion exactly as you would like it to be. And strange or not so strange, it'll probably be a religion that focuses on you. because in a postmodern world, that's what it's about. Even science is considered to no longer be rational, that science can in fact be biased by the background of the individuals. And lastly, psychology is a really interesting area of playing with people's minds. And postmodern teaching for psychology says the therapist should never seek to correct the patient's view by comparing it to any standard of truth, since nothing is right or wrong or true or untrue. It's a delightful world in which we live. And of course, as you know and I know, the tragedy of a world in which nothing is right or wrong or true or untrue is, well, it doesn't matter anymore about anything, does it? Because who cares? If there's nothing right and nothing wrong and nothing true or nothing untrue, then there's really no point to anything, because truth itself no longer has any value and no longer has any meaning. In fact, as a result of that, what happens is truth dies, because truth is now constructed by the individual. And it's a relative term that can't be fixed by any outside reality. And since reality itself is only individual opinion, there can be no such thing as absolute truth. You know how the Bible begins? Start the Bible for me. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. So light had a moral value attached to it. And if light was good, what was the implication for darkness? Darkness was evil. So there were absolutes in terms of God's planning. Right from the beginning, on the first day, we had light versus darkness. We have good versus evil. We have truth versus error. We have that distinguishing that the world does not want to have and does not want to accept in the postmodern age in which we live. So here's a study done in the USA in 2002. And what they did is they asked people whether they agreed with this statement, is that moral truth is relative to circumstances, which is really saying a moral truth is a moral truth until I decide it isn't a moral truth, or I don't want it to be a moral truth. So instead of being absolute, it's relative to the circumstances. There might be times when I decide that it isn't a moral truth. Understand what I'm saying here? That was the question. We would tend to take the view as that light is light and dark is dark and good is good and evil is evil, because that's what God says and that's what God teaches, and therefore moral principles are absolute truths. So they asked this question. And then the second question they asked was, and they weren't relating these two, they were separate questions with separate responses. The second question was, do you agree with this statement that moral truth is absolute and unchanging? Now, here's the responses. This is where it gets really interesting, because they broke the research. This was done in 2002 by Barner. They broke the research into adults versus teenagers. So how many adults do you think believe that moral truth was relative to circumstances as a percentage? You would like to have a guess?
75.
75 thought that moral truth was... So in other words, 75% didn't think that moral truths were absolute, they were relative to the circumstances. So three quarters of the country you think thought that moral truth could be changed at will. Is that what you think?
Under 50%.
Under 50%? Okay, because it's a religious place, the USA, isn't it? Bible-based, you know, community. Actually, it was 64%. So what that means is that two-thirds of the USA, in a broad spectrum analysis, said that we believe that moral truth is sort of dependent on the circumstances. It could shift if we want it to. Two-thirds of the adult population. Pretty bad, huh? Oh, no, that's not bad. 83% of teenagers agreed with the fact that moral truth was depending on the circumstances. Now, you know what's interesting about that? So 2002. So when did that man write that humanist statement about teaching in the classrooms? 1983? 1993? 2003? 20 years later. What do you think the effect of that 20 years worth of seed of the flesh, seed of the serpent thinking and teaching in the school system has been, that in one generation, the number of people that believe that moral truth is relative to circumstances jumped by another 20%, another 20% of the population. One generation of humanistic thinking. Mind you, in a good place like the USA, you'd think that at least a number of people were clear on the second one, that moral truth is absolute. What do you reckon the percentage would be that of the adult population that thought that moral truths were absolute, as indeed they should? You would like to hazard a guess?
20.
Pretty good. 22%. Could be skewed by the New Yorkers, by the Detroiters, you know. Detroiters could have pulled the numbers up, you know. But the really, really spooky stat is this one. 6% of teenagers thought that moral truth was absolute. In one generation, the seed of the serpent teaching in the school system has essentially destroyed the notion that there is any absolute truth on any topic in life in that generation. Now, gentlemen, many of you are part of that generation, and you haven't even begun to raise your households yet. What age will your children grow up into? That was a decade ago. That was 15 years ago. Imagine bringing up a godly seed today in a family and in an ecclesia. You think we've got a war on our hands? I think so. This is the challenge that we're facing, and that is the erosive power, the corrosive power of seed of the serpent thinking as it works its way through the community. And therefore, isn't it such a relief to come to the Bible and find that God deals in absolute truths? God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, and God saw that the light was good. And John says, "Light has come into the world, men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil, for everyone that doeth evil hateth the light." Light is good, darkness is evil. And Job in the middle says, "I looked for good and then evil came. I waited for light and there came darkness." And Job parallels the two. He says light is the good and darkness is the evil. And from God's perspective, they're absolute truths. Incidentally, when it's light in Canada or the USA or New Zealand, do you think that light means light every morning when the sun rises? Yes. And when the sun goes down, is darkness dark? Yes, it's dark everywhere, or it's light everywhere. They're absolute truths everywhere. It doesn't matter where you are on the planet. Light and dark are opposite terms. And God says, so are good and evil. So's the thinking of the spirit and the thinking of the flesh. And the reality is, and what a good way for us to start our studies together is this confession, is that actually what the Bible teaches is that man in his own native state is actually in a situation of ignorant darkness before God, which is the appropriate spirit for us to begin our weekend together. And so Proverbs chapter 4 and verses 18 and 19 says, "The path of the just is as the shining light, but the way of the wicked is as darkness. They know not at what they stumble." Or again in Ecclesiastes 6 verses 4 and 5, "For he cometh in and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered in darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun, nor known anything." And again in John chapter 12 verse 35, "Walk while ye have the light, lest darkness come upon you. For he that walketh in darkness knoweth not whither he goeth." And so notice the key here, you see. They know not, it says. They do not know, it says. They do not know, says Proverbs 4 and Ecclesiastes 6 and John 12. That's what it means to be in darkness. You don't know. You don't know the answers. Only God does. Man doesn't have the answers. Man's native and natural state is that he is in the darkness of ignorance and totally depends upon God, who alone is the source of light. And that's in fact what the Bible says, that God is the source of enlightenment. So Psalm 18 verse 28 says, "For thou wilt light my lamp, Yahweh my God will enlighten my darkness." Oh, you see what it says? Yahweh my God will enlighten, he's the source of light, my darkness. It's my darkness, it's God's light. See that contrast? It's his light, not ours. It's our darkness. Or Daniel chapter 2, he revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness. Man doesn't. God does. And the light dwelleth with him. It is part of the Father's makeup. That ye should show forth, says the 1st of Peter chapter 2, the praises of him who's called you out of darkness into his marvellous light. Now, you see, there's a real spirit of humility involved in this, isn't there? That we come at the beginning of our studies with that free will confession to the Father that we haven't got the answers. We don't know what's right. We don't know what the truth is. God does, and God alone does. We confess that we're in a state of darkness before him, and we start our weekend, as it were, with that spirit. So let's open our Bibles and look at several passages just to summarise the spirit, at least, of this session. And we'll start by going to Isaiah 55. I'll leave that on because I may... Do I disappear into the shadows when I do that? So at the risk of keeping that up and being a distraction, normally I would switch it off. That would be my agreed process. But for the sake of let there be light, we'll leave it on. So Isaiah 55 says, and, you know, these are all verses that we know well, but it is good to just review them and think about them in the context of what we've covered in this opening session. So Isaiah 55 verses 6 to 9 says, "Seek ye Yahweh while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto Yahweh, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways." So just notice that connection back in verse 7. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith Yahweh. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. And really what we're being told in Isaiah 55 is that God's thinking is absolutely and totally on a different plane to ours. And so all our endeavours to be good or diligent or faithful are of no value if they're driven by our own thinking, because God's thoughts are not the same. You see, God doesn't want us running around the ecclesia keeping busy without the inspiration of his thinking as the driver of what we do. Whatever we do must be the outworking of our thinking. It's not the mere performance of activity in the truth. The truth is all about hearts and minds being inspired by divine principles to do what we do, and to do it because we seek to manifest the Father deliberately and knowingly. But activity, absent the principle, is not God manifestation. So when people talk about Christians that do good works, that's the activity. But without being driven by the understanding of God's principles, it's still not God manifestation, it's simply activity. And because his ways are not the same as ours, we've got to find out about his ways, because his ways are supreme and our ways are terribly unimportant. And the only place where we can find out God's thoughts, the only place where we can find out God's ways, is in the book. So we've got to get our heads into the book, because there's no other place where we can discover God's ways and God's thought. And so Psalm 119 says something similar. Do you remember that section about wherewithal shall a young man cleanse his way? It's in the section marked Beth, starting from verse 9. Psalm 119 and verses 9 to 16. And so the record says, wherewithal shall a young man cleanse his way? By taking heed thereto according to thy word. With my whole heart have I sought thee. O, let me not wander from thy commandments. Thy word have I hid in mine heart, that I might not sin against thee. Blessed art thou, O Yahweh, teach me thy statutes. With my lips have I declared all the judgments of thy mouth. I have rejoiced in the way of thy testimonies as much as in all riches. I will meditate in thy precepts and have respect unto thy ways. I will delight myself in thy statutes, and I will not forget thy word. And so I think what we learn from this, incidentally, is that the Bible is not for intellectuals. The Bible is not for academics. The Bible is not for scholars. The Bible is not for linguists. The Bible is for ordinary people like you and me who can read it with good and honest hearts and understand what God wants to tell us. That's who the Bible's for. It's those who sincerely want to understand the thinking of the Spirit. And that's why God's written it in the way he has. And so, whoops, obviously didn't have that separated out. So we study the scripture in order to understand his principles and his thoughts. And that takes us to that passage in Corinthians. So let's just have a look at that. The 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And verses 19 to 25. So it says there, it is written, I'll destroy the wisdom of the wise, and I'll bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness, but unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And so what we're being told here, as in so many other parts of Scripture, is that we want to be inspired by divine principles because they're not on the same plane as the thinking of the flesh. And God's thinking and God's teaching has never been the same as the thinking of the flesh. In fact, I think one of the things that we want to establish again out of our weekend is to try and understand the difference between law and principle. You see, we don't want to be keepers of law, but we do want to be followers of principle. Law-keeping in ecclesial life or family life is still at its heart Judaism. The keeping of a law simply because the law exists. But principle-keeping is because we've understood the divine principle that sits behind the law, and in knowing and loving that principle, we want now to have that take the moral force in our lives of something that we want to live for and live by. And lastly, do you remember in Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 20 when it says, well, can anyone quote Isaiah chapter 8 verse 20 off the cuff for me?
To the law.
To the law.
To the law
and to the testimony. If they speak not according to this word, it is because there is
no light in them.
Actually, I think the margin says no mourning in them. And perhaps that's an interesting comment on the fact that the mourning of the kingdom age, the mourning of the resurrection, the mourning of immortality is not a mourning that any of these people will know or understand or participate in if they speak not according to this word. But if we take the authorized version rendering, it's because there's no light in them, then it's still an absolute truth as well, isn't it? That what we're seeking to do is to have the light of God's word as the basis for our belief and our practice in life. Now, just one last passage. It's in Psalm 145. And if anyone's got this marked, they might just like to make a comment about this. But in Psalm 145, it mentions the word speak in several verses, but they're not the same word. So Psalm 145 and verse 5 says, I will speak of the glorious honour of thy majesty. And Psalm 145 verse 11 says, they shall speak of the glory of thy kingdom and talk of thy power. And verse 21 says, my mouth shall speak the praise of Yahweh, and let all flesh bless his holy name forever and ever. Has anyone got those words marked in their margin at all? Anyone got them marked in the margin? Any comments on those words? By the way, have we got access to concordances here in the weekend? We probably do. You know, so just as a little piece of homework, you might like to look up those three words for speak in verse 5 and verse 11 and verse 21. What's that?
I got meditate in verse 5.
So meditate in verse 5. You got that as a marginal comment, Richard? Okay.
In my version here.
Yep. Oh, you mean in the version you've got? Yes. Okay. So, whereas in verse 11, for example, the word means to declare convincingly. Anyway, you'll find that the word speak is the three different words. And I think what they do is they help to convey the range of what Bible study is all about. And one of the key words is the one that Richard mentioned, and that is that, and I think it's helpful in terms of what we're talking about here, is I like the word meditation. Because when we talk about Bible study, what does that convey? If you say to someone, do you do Bible study? What does that sound like? What does the phrase Bible study convey? Any thoughts? A, it's academic. B, it's intellectual. C, there could be an exam at the end. I'm cramming at the moment because I've got an exam coming up, Bible study, doing my Bible study. Actually, meditation is a better word, isn't it? Because meditation conveys that idea of reflecting on divine teaching so that we might absorb principles which have actually got nothing to do about examinations and everything to do about successful living before God in allowing his purpose to be outworked in our lives. So that word for meditation that's hidden in one of those three words for speak in Psalm 145 is very much the spirit of what we're seeking to do in all of our Bible activity. We're seeking to meditate upon Bible principles so that we can know the Father's mind, and in knowing the Father's mind, we can better reflect him. And that, of course, is the fundamental purpose to which we've been called. So why are we studying the Bible? We're studying the Bible because we're in a battle between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, between the thinking of the spirit and the thinking of the flesh. The battle is real, the battle is ongoing, and the seed of the serpent is already winning. And we have a charge to purify our own minds so that we think spiritually, and then to be an influence for good in our ecclesias and in our families, that we can give a lead to that mode of spiritual thinking that should govern all of our behaviour and all of our decisions so that we manifest the Father more perfectly in our lives. That's the primary objective of doing all this. I'll finish actually with another quotation, see if you can quote the balance of it. Brother John Carter, the mind
is sensibly affected by the train of thought passing through.
Now, it's interesting actually, I think that being pedantic with regard to the English, Incidentally, I totally agree with that. I think what he said was, the mind insensibly is, rather than is insensibly. It's just a little subtlety about how he expresses it. You agree with that, John?
No.
Oh, you don't? You think it's the other way around?
No.
Okay.
I just knew is came at some point.
Okay. Well, you know, is only a little word, but, you know, it's to do with the... Actually, you've just given me an excellent introduction to our next section. So the mind insensibly is affected by the stream of thought passing through it. And then what did Brother Carter say? It is desirable, therefore, to keep the stream as pure as possible. Don't you reckon that's a good... Oh, I think that's a great quotation. The mind insensibly is affected by the stream of thought passing through it. Red line or blue line? It is desirable, therefore, to keep the stream, blue line, as pure as possible. The only way we can keep that stream of thought pure is by immersing our minds in the divine testimony day by day. So let's close at that point. It's 9 o'clock, time for that delicious 5-minute break. But before I allow you to depart for that brief moment of relaxation, I just need to explain the second session, because it's not actually a talk. It's something that you're going to do. So I'm going to need your cooperation with regard to this. The second session is how to become an excellent Bible reader. And I'm going to talk about, just briefly, about good reading when we come back. But what we're going to do tonight is to have a few volunteers to actually stand up and deliver a reading. And so when we get back, we won't do it now, but when we get back, what I want you to do is to sit at your tables of four and collaborate together to decide amongst you, so it must be by mutual consent, a passage anywhere from the Bible that you think is absolutely dramatic and interesting to read, covering no more than 5 verses maximum, anywhere in the Bible, because there's some tremendous passages in the Scriptures. And then we're going to invite a set of volunteers to come up and read them. And we're going to talk about how they read it and whether it actually was an excellent reading. Now, we're going to follow the formula of a praise sandwich. Is everyone familiar with the praise sandwich methodology? So when it comes to mutual critiquing, a la mutual improvement classes, the correct option probably to follow is say something positive about what they did, mention a critique of something they could improve and do better, and then close by saying something further positive about what they did. That's a praise sandwich. That becomes a good way for critiquing people. Understand? So go and have 5 minutes to relax, but your task when you get back is to convene in groups of four and by consent give me a dramatic passage of no more than 5 verses that we can use for reading. Thank you.